rejection of the physical, rejection of the body through aesthetic practices, which would harm the body, like excessive fasting and so on, was not the way.
Right.
And again, it comes back to our discussion yesterday of the, you know, the licentious Gnosticism, if you will, and Gnosticism with a capital G, that using why Tantrayana is so fascinating, or Vajrayana, is because it uses the forms, the realm of form, literally, as the medium of transformation, not rejecting form,
right,
but dying into the form.
Right, right.
And it's impractical, ultimately.
What is?
To reject form, since you're living in it. I mean, that's a simplistic statement, but when you get down to the root of the matter, particularly, you know, when you were talking about no penicillin, I was delighting with laughter because we just spent a month, you know, in the rural Himalayas where there's not only no penicillin, but there's not very developed concept of herbal medicine. So that the whole lifestyle is extremely demanding. Ultimately, it gets down to a very sort of practical template. I mean, you're living in a way that you realize you have to put so much into your body and you have to do certain kinds of things in order to survive. And if you don't, you become ill and die very rapidly. And I imagine, you know, prior to developed concept of medicine, all the various concepts of medicine, that no matter how evolved one's spiritual ideas are, without taking the practical into consideration, which is working within the realm of form, is not necessarily very, it's not very helpful in terms of ultimate survival in this world. So using these things of this world instead of rejecting them.
Keith.
Two things that have come up during our discussion. One is when you separate the Gnosticism with a capital G and the small G, this is something that I've done, I realized, for many years, only I didn't word it quite that way. I always said there's two Christianities, the one which is taught by Jesus and the one which is taught about Jesus. So that may be a similarity. The other thing, it occurred to me, when you use the words entrapment by material things, if we start looking at that in kind of metamorphical, no, as a metaphor,
metaphorical
manner, instead of the literal thing that you would expect from perhaps an ancient society, why then you open all sorts of doors, because the entrapment of spirituality by materialism is a subject which is discussed in many ways by many persuasions, and it's really not either particularly unique or as prohibitive.
Well, let me put it in just continuing on with this, and we're going to have to watch ourselves, because this is a real problem. I mean, we could spend a long time on this. Let me take the devil's advocate side of the element of Gnosticism that I bounce away from, and see if we can get into what they were after, so at least we see why they said this kind of thing. How far can we push the our understanding of the opposing position. Now, all right, to do that, well, now we're going to begin with the premise that there is something about matter that is unsatisfactory. Now, let's detail that. First of all, there is a separation. Am I right? They can never fuse one into the other, much as we try. You know, even in sexual intercourse, the kind of ultimate effort of matter to express and realize this urge through all being, urge of oneness. Well, our spirits merge, our bodies a little bit. But there is still this externality, impossible for two objects, and therefore separation is a correlate of matter. Now, there's something else, and that has to do with time. What we've just said has to do with space. Now we go to time. Everything physical is transitory, is passing. Even the hills, said Tennyson, are shadows, you know. Shadows move. And so do the mountains, the hills. The time scale is somewhat different. The Buddhist way is anicca, impermanent. And there's no way of matter becoming exempt from that. The pharaohs built their pyramids in vain efforts. What's that poem? My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. But then around those crumbled ruins, the sand stretched bleak and bare, or something like that, I forget the word. Effort to keep the material monument, something in matter, permanent, and we know it's veil. Now, I'm about to persuade myself on that side. I have to watch that. But there, that's true. That's true. Now, what are we to draw from that? Well, you know, let me just be rash and just let the words flow as they will without having considered them carefully. And that is that. Now let's come over to the other side. You see, matter in human experience is never matter only. It's always matter interfused, interpenetrated with mind, feeling, spirit, because it's always a part of experience. So experience is always fused with it. Now, the kind of thing that Joan was saying so eloquently a few minutes ago, and that I certainly would want to hold out for categorically, absolutely, is that we can experience matter as wonderful, as sublime. And of course, we should attempt that to increase our capacity to do so. So it's not as though we should extract feelings, awareness from the matter and have these only good, but we can carry that, those feelings, those awarenesses right into the material world, and there's no limit to the degree of perfection we can find in our experience of the material. However, having said that, the spirit, which is, am I right, not ultimately material, must have a mode of being which is not subject to these two negative aspects of matter. Does that sound right? Or maybe it's getting a little
too...
All right, yeah. Oh, I was going to say, maybe it's a little too abstruse for...
No, it's beautiful.
I enjoyed what you said. I wonder if we're not all a little structured with the split that perhaps Descartes was largely responsible for, and if we believe at least somewhat what modern physicists tell us, I'm not so sure that this is a real split. It may be that we are making a distinction between flowing water and ice, and perhaps there is no real distinction except in our mind's eye and the way we see it between these two things. And if that was the case, then what the Gnostics perhaps are saying is, let's not hold on to frozen matter, let's let it move.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excuse me.
Good. I like that.
I love that motto.
Yeah.
And, you know, it knits right into what Houston was talking about, because our mind's eye is structured by time.
Certainly.
And so, therefore, where we relate to matter is in terms of the experience of time. And
so whatever this universe is...
Then we get into, let me just throw a curve, okay, just for the fun of it, because I keep coming, it's shunyata, void,
right.
great-great-grandmother space,
right.
The emptiness that is the ground or foundation for all. Where does this dance? Because there's no time, there's no space, there's no matter, there's no spirit. There's no consciousness without an object. In fact, where is consciousness in that? God knows we could spend the next, you know, century discussing that. Where does emptiness dance in, just to step into the foundational field, dance into what you're talking about now?
Well, it's in this, what visually we're putting over here. Namely... Well, I don't know. No, maybe that's not right. Certainly we can say, can we not, that emptiness is not exclusively material, but now I was going to put it over here, but that's probably wrong. It's probably the whole shebang.
To me, a very advanced concept has to do with the concept of emptiness.
Oh, well, like the ultimate or something. Yeah, very advanced.
Does it play into Gnosticism, big or small g?
Oh, well, that's good. I think it plays into Valentinian Gnosticism as of yesterday, which has a subtlety
with the concept of the infinite.
That's right. That's right. So I think you do find it, but I think because it got suppressed, why, it just sort of stayed there. It wasn't worked with. And maybe what we need to do is discovering our Western roots. Some of those who want to do that is to go back and unearth that, brush that off, that bright round mirror.
Matter, time matter, is a heavy manifestation of what Myron was saying, of spirit. So just playing into the Vedic world, to materialize an object, what you're basically doing is capturing the imaginal, the image, literally playing with the dimension of time to slow it down into the heavier
form.
Oh,
that's very nice. Okay. That's very nice.
So, you know, spirit, ultimately in that concept, is an intermediary state, or an intermediate state, because there's something beyond spirit, and that's what prompted the question, one of the thorns that prompted the question, where does emptiness dance in where we're playing now, because that's the foundation, if you will, in a number of traditions, sacred traditions, of everything.
All right. Now, I like that very much, but with one question. Spirit is midway between what? Matter and emptiness?
Yes, between matter and emptiness, between the void and mm-hmm. emptiness.
All right.
It has nature, you know, it has qualities.
Because it has qualities. Is that what you're saying? I didn't hear the last statement.
Well, there are conditions which characterize spirit. All right, and those conditions, it's like in the Tibetan world, it's those conditions are characterized by, we'll go to Hindu, Satchitananda.
Right.
All right, that would be what we could call the highest realm of spirit, you know, infinite being, infinite knowledge, infinite bliss.
You see, I'm to say that spirit, to position spirit midway, mm-hmm. I'm having, I have to think about that, because I think for the Gnostics, the spirit, and you get it in the New Testament, God is spirit, that there's no more ultimate than that. But now you're proposing something, so I want to know what the... what the emptiness has got that spirit doesn't.
Well, it's what spirit has that emptiness doesn't.
You're asking?
Yeah. I, this is, needless to say, the origin of this question is in this discussion for me, personally, so I'm just interested.
Yeah. Well, I equate spirit with emptiness.
Okay. Well, I don't.
Okay. I don't. Can I tell you a little irrelevant story? But it's so nice, and it turns on I don't. Baker Roshi, when he was in Syracuse, November 2, told about he has one 19-year-old daughter, and now they started again, and one that's four, and the 4-year-old, the 19 was very. Serene and always wanted to know how you were, but the 4-year-old wants you to know how she is. And at one point, Roshi was really down to the wire and getting off on a trip or something, and she was charging around the room, somersault, sliding down backs of chairs, and he tried to calm her down so he could get his things together and no luck. Finally, he said, Elizabeth, you're behaving like a boy, said. Girls simply sit on divans with their arms folded over a doll, gazing out of into space with a half smile. And Elizabeth said, well, some don't. And she added, I'm the leader of those that don't. So, Joan, I don't equate shunyata with spirit.
Do you equate shunyata
Pardon?
With spirit? Well, if you don't equate shunyata with spirit, then we're in accord.
No, I was paraphrasing you.
Oh, I see.
You're the leader of those who don't. Well, now, if you want, you're pausing for a moment. Let me say something in terms of equating them and ask how this image, we're dealing with images and we know that they're only... carry us only so far because the ineffable is to be respected. But last night, when we were looking at the Krishnamurti film, my mind went back to David Bohm, who has been a follower of Krishnamurti for 20 years, spends a month, his month's vacation, right here in Ojai, where he has an apartment reserved for him at all times. And he was with us at I brought him to Syracuse for 3 weeks. You know, he's this eminent physicist. Now, during those 3 weeks and the lectures that he gave, I learned a little bit of physics, but one of the things that he presented is this extraordinary statistic that there is more energy in a thimbleful of vacuum than there is in all the matter in this universe. Now, that is something to ponder. Because let's start first with a thimbleful of vacuum. We called it a vacuum because we thought there was nothing there. We were mistaken. It turns out there is, but it happens to be very small. So small that we overlooked it, and so we thought that the vacuum was empty. Now, but that, when you think about those proportions, the amount of energy in all the matter in this universe. Now, by that energy, we're talking about that which links electrons to their nuclei. And we know how powerful that is, that because it took atom smashers the amount of energy they had to get to blast those things apart. And we know how much of that kind of energy there was in, 2 pounds of uranium over Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Lord help us. But when you think that was only 2 pounds, now let's go to the size of the universe, 13 billion light years across, we know how fast light travels, how much matter there is, but all of that energy, we just collapse that 13 billion light years down to the 1 centimeter square, and we've got all that energy here. But now note, in what form? It's not matter, because matter is defined by rest mass, and there's no rest mass there. There's only energy. Now, Joan, what that does to me, the way that sort of impacts my imagination, is to imagine a state of awareness in which there is no material component. There is the equivalent of energy would be awareness, and maybe if we follow Myron in saying maybe we don't have to get caught in the Cartesian split, that could be translated, the energy, or maybe even on a more ultimate level, because David Bohm says that's only the first stage at which we become aware of it, but that's still an explicate order compared with the implicate, which is truly ineffable, defies our ability to image in any form, what I'm holding out for is the possibility of a mode of awareness which is in which materiality, by all the rubrics, the matrices that by which it is known to us, simply isn't there. Now, how does that? What do you think of that?
How can you even think of that?
Well, that's for,
you know, when you define spirit in those terms, to fish for an equation in the world of physics, it would be that it would be the space, if you will, that has nothing in it, the vacuum, but the vacuum that is truly empty, in essence.
Yeah.
Which would be, I mean, it's like I'm trying to link from that concept into the concept of Atman, where that vacuum, if you will, that emptiness that is filled with energy lives within the human psychobiological human experience, right? And then, you know, dancing out of the Atman into the whole realm of spirit from the concept that you've just been playing with. Yeah, then I would agree with you. If that is how you define spirit, then using the Atman concept, yes, I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
That spirit, from that point of view, thus contains nothing,
mm-hmm.
is completely empty, and paradoxically is the foundation for everything.
Right, right, right.
It's the, you know, generative void.
Yeah.
Okay, but that I, you know.
Right.
It contains everything in potential.
Right. That's it. Mm. Okay, thank you.
In the Jewish mystical tradition, it goes a lot into this area. There's an area which is known as the Ein Sof.
Ein Sof, the infinite.
Which is before anything. I mean,
right.
Which is, it's everything, nothing, simultaneously.
Right.
It's beyond time, so you can't even talk about simultaneous.
That's right.
And then that goes into another form, which is still incomprehensible, and it has to emanate down several levels before it becomes part of an experience.
Perfect.
Fantastic.
Perfect.
Okay, so where does... I know this isn't necessarily related to Gnosticism, but in how you describe... What we're describing is... it's a continuum of sorts. All right, where does consciousness...
Consciousness comes down quite a ways. Consciousness does not come into being.
The conscious without an object.
Consciousness without an object. Okay, I'm not sure what you mean by consciousness without an object. But I mean, it's hard to think about nothing. You can't. It just really blows your mind about being in that space. But in that place, okay. Balance, okay, the law of the Kabbalah is balance. And perfect balance actually exists ever so much into that Ein Sof, into non-existence. So there's never complete balance. You have to come the slightest fraction out of balance before you have what is called the Tree of Life, which comes in.
The beginning of manifestation.
Which manifests, which starts with the finest spark. Starts with the spark, just... And then it becomes wisdom and understanding and other attributes. Mm-hmm. But that empty space, it's very interesting. A way that I like thinking about it, which is I like to think of it as being existence and non-existence, simultaneously happening just there and not there. And then for it to manifest, something had to happen. There had to be like almost an illusion or a lie or something put in there.
An irritation.
For it to see itself. And then as soon as it totally realized itself, it totally not exist again. Okay, and it goes back into the Ein Sof. And then just for a split, not even a second, the quickest period of time that it could be, it exists for a second and it realizes itself and then it ceases to exist again. And that's the first level. And then something happens which, like maybe forgets about itself, and you know, it words, and then it sort of forgets that it is itself, and then it sort of starts losing this ultimate realization. That allows it to persist, because you know, it has to persist, otherwise it's nothing. Otherwise we realize ourselves and then we just don't exist anymore.
It's boring.
So there seems to be a process that moves from this Ein Sof to a level that we're here, where we're totally divided and we're seeing that our one as you and you and you and you, and somehow that, you know, allows us to exist here. Because, you know, if we're one, then we don't exist anymore. You know, if I totally, you know, like
in
the sex act.
And then we come to the realization, then we don't
exist
anymore.
Mm-hmm. And it keeps moving down, but then it can go to one extreme, where there's just total division, mm-hmm. where it just goes into oblivion in the other direction. So there's sort of somewhere a balance between that and the truth.
You know, I immediately associate to it, again, excuse me for being so heavily Buddhistic. I ask you, it's inevitable at this point in my own situation. But to the concept of mind moments, and that this, what you're talking about in the Buddhist world would be the mini gap between mind moments, all right, would be the emptiness between the pulse of the mind moments. Mind moments is self-reflexive awareness. And our job in practice is basically to come into the present so that we can experience each mind moment. And then the next job on the wheel of the Zen wheel that Sansanin has, you know, teaches is that in that aspect of the gap, knowing the gap place, the emptiness that pulses between the content of the mind moments. And then knowing the two, like almost like spirit and matter, or energy and matter, the interplay of the two and how they create consciousness and awareness, just to play. And I bet that knowing that there's a kind of I bet there's a sexual connotation to these, in the sense that frequently the matrix of emptiness is associated with the feminine, and the content aspect is associated with the masculine. So you have it flipping between, even though we frequently associate matter with feminine, but in many cosmologies it's the other way.
It's very interesting.
So you have this extraordinary vacillation between the feminine and the masculine, and the dance, again, going back to some of the content of Thomas, is the equalization of these two dimensions, one that has no is totally dimensionless, and the other which is characterized by absolute dimensionality. Well, you know, we can't even get there until we eliminate the past, apropos of last night's discussion, Krishnamurti, and the future.
But then even the past and the future may have its place, only it has to be kept in that place. I mean, you cannot function in this realm without a past and a future. I would hate, you know, we need conditioning. We have to be conditioned to exist here. Like, I would hate to have to learn how to drive a car every time I step inside the car.
Right.
So all these things have their place, but we tend to mix them up. We tend to make, you know, machines and standards out of something that has no standard, meaning the human being.
Or the planet. Just to dance into the medicine wheel concept, one of the problems in various religious traditions, and I know Myron, having been an aficionado of Joe, and I having danced with Joe along, Joseph Campbell, and you, Houston, and those of us who have done it, is seeing so many different systems comparatively, and you realize, this one denies this, and this one denies that, and there's always some sort of limitation. So that it seems that the great challenge for our era is to accomplish accomplish all points on the medicine wheel, if you will, all the perspectives, you know, the emptiness aspect, the form aspect, so we don't get identified with emptiness. We don't get identified with form, but we see both as within the realm of the infant, to go back to Valentinus, that the infinite contains both or all these different manifestations. And then we go into means or methods, which you were, you know, in discussion about last night with Kay, because this discursive analysis is illuminating in terms of, you know, conceptual exploration of concepts, but the attainment dimension.
That's a different mode of knowledge, yeah. And there again, both Asia and Gnosticism recognize that point immensely, that the other kind of knowledge has a saving function too, but it's only propedeutic to
it's
that.
Only what?
Oh, propedeutic, kind of leading up to, preliminary.
Okay.
That it can help to set the stage for moving in of this non-discursive mode of knowledge, which was the fifth mode of the Gnostic. Yes, Martha.
May I speak a little bit of my ignorance?
Yeah, well, sure. We just share our
ignorance. I was thinking, I mean, this is the way I have summarized it before I came to this group, and I think that this might summarize what I'm thinking right now. Is that the, we should experience the matter, but the spirit should control the matter and not the matter control the spirit. This has been my experience too. I used to think I had to have a late model sports car, a material thing, in order to be happy. I found out that that isn't what's necessary.
Right.
That doesn't fill the emptiness.
Right.
And I kept looking for these material things that fill the emptiness. But that they didn't. I learned that the spirit had to control. And the other thing is on each religion, I believe, has some of the truth. And if we would take the pieces of the puzzle and learn how to put them together, I believe we would have the whole truth.
Well, I want to step in on that and suggest something different. Each of the religions has a piece of the truth. And if we could put them all together, jigsaw puzzle, you didn't use that image, why then we would have the whole truth. I would like to suggest something else that I'm becoming more and more convinced of, namely that each of these traditions has the whole truth.
Has the whole truth.
Right. But it emphasizes different aspects of it. You see, I think that traditions are too, what should we say, sinuous and in a way kind of tough and resilient to lend themselves to our finite human pastiche, is there a word like that? You know, a collage. We will put them together. You know, that's dreams of glory in a way that's really going to reflect the things they are. I think they wouldn't have existed all these centuries and with all their ills have serviced the millions and millions of people they did if they didn't have a pretty good grip on the nature of things. And that rather than our doing a kind of cafeteria, you know, assembling the beautiful tray that will satisfy all gustatory longings. Rather than that, let's stay. And this is why the great traditions are my enduring field of study, because the deeper you go, the more you find a Valentinus. If you hadn't skillfully gotten me into this, I might have passed by forever. They're there.
But then you could say that the whole truth is contained in each religion.
Right.
And that it is presented in that way to help certain one's right. Find.
Now, we can forget certain important parts, and we're right here in these 2 days in a brilliant case study, I think, of just what has happened with regard to our Western tradition. And now we're getting a handle on that, which shows some hope that in this time when traditions in the West are at sixes and sevens, there might be a new vitality through a new amplitude that we see in those traditions.
And then I have a question about Bond. Now, I believe he refers to the implicit and
explicit
as enfolded and unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
That's Pilgrim's.
Huh?
No, enfolded and unfolded.
Enfolded and unfolded.
Right.
And he was also a close associate of Einstein. So while you were talking about that, I was wondering how does the theory of relativity, E equal mc squared, fit into what you were discussing about energy?
All right. Well, I think there's one obvious way that the convertibility between matter and energy, that what gets explicated as matter gets implicated as energy. Is that all right?
But I think that we might take it, what is implicated is then...
is energy.
And then...
no matter.
It then comes down to the visible world. First and then...
that's right. Only energy first. And then it splays out. Myron's notion, the water freezes into ice. And it has its... loses its flexibility, its suppleness, and gets chunky cakes and collides.
So then it's implicit first.
Right.
And it comes down to the explicit. So
right.
Then the implicit creates whatever is manifest.
Right.
Physical love.
All right.
Does that fit into the Gnostic teachings?
Very much so. Very much so.
The thing is, though, is it vacillates between one and the other.
Can't really say which is first. It's outside of time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's going back and forth. According to Bohm, it's one thing, then it's the other. It's just like what was being talked about before. It's both nothing and everything. The universe, matter, and energy.
Leon.
I just wondered whether you consider Gnosticism separate from Christianity, separate from everything else, as a separate religion.
All right. Good. And with that, maybe it's well, I've liked this last half hour or 40 minutes. I think that this is really marvelous and profound stuff. But let's get back to Gnosticism and whether I consider it separate from Christian. Well, there's. Let me see if this speaks to what you have in mind. Gnosticism is essentially a perspective, a point of view. And that is far beyond Christianity. Just laps around it in various forms that we've looked at. We saw yesterday Manichaeanism and the Hermetic tradition and so on are simply example, to say nothing of the Gnostic emphasis in Jhana Yoga in India. So, yes, Gnosticism as a point of view is far greater in scope and extent than its Christian manifestation. I think what's become exciting in our time with the Nag Hammadi Library is the discovery that this point of view was also present within Christendom, and goes back right to the time and very likely to the person of Christ himself. But for certain reasons became suppressed. And so we've had a Christianity which has been, by virtue of that suppression,